Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today we're going to be talking about six of the presentations that were covered in the 17th Congress of the European Crohn's and Colitis Organization, better known as ECCO. And this was held as a virtual event this year, held between the 16th and the 19th of February, 2022. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
The Lucent 1 trial was presented by Professor Geert de Haans from the Amsterdam University Medical Center in the Netherlands. And these results looked at the drug mirikizumab and whether it was more efficacious than a placebo as induction therapy for participants with active ulcerative colitis, or UC. This was a phase 3 trial, and it, again, like I said, it mentioned mirikizumab. It's an IgG4 monoclonal antibody, which targets IL-23, interleukin-23. And in the phase 2 study that ran before this, this agent outperformed placebo in participants with active ulcerative colitis. The multicenter double-blinded phase 3 LUCENT-1 trial then randomized patients with moderately to severe active UC who failed on at least one prior therapy to mirikizumab, so there were 959 patients in that arm, or to placebo, and that was a 322-patient arm. Participants in the experimental arm received 400 milligrams mirikizumab intravenously at weeks 0, 4, and 8, and clinical remission at week 12 was the primary endpoint of this study. At week 12, the clinical remission rate was significantly higher in the mirikizumab arm at 24.2% versus the placebo arm, which was only 13.3%, so highly significant p-value. In the biologic-naive participant stratum, clinical remission rates were significantly higher in the mirikizumab arm at 30.9% versus 15.8%, again significant. Mirikizumab showed a numerical benefit with regard to clinical remission in the subset of participants who failed on a prior biologic therapy, and that was 15.2% versus 8.5%, and that did not quite reach significance statistically. Furthermore, mirikizumab outperformed placebo on all key secondary endpoints, including clinical response, at 63.5% versus 42.2%, endoscopic remission, which had 36.3% versus 21%, histologic endoscopic mucosal improvement, which was really quite impressive at 27.1% versus 13.9%, and bowel urgency. Notably, 4 weeks after treatment initiation, mirikizumab receivers already demonstrated a significant improvement in symptomatic remission compared with placebo receivers. The safety analysis did not display unexpected safety issues of mirikizumab therapy. Treatment-related adverse events occurred in 46% of the participants in the placebo arm and in 44% of participants in the mirikizumab arm. Serious adverse events were more frequently reported in the placebo arm than in the intervention arm. Those were the results from the Phase 3 LUCENT-1 study. Also at ECCO, the Phase 3 U-Achieve Maintenance study was presented by Professor Silvio Danese from the University of Vita Salute in San Raffaele, Italy, near Rome. And this was a study that looked at the secondary endpoints of the U-Achieve Maintenance trial. So in U-Achieve, the induction and the U-Accomplish trials, they showed that induction therapy with a JAK inhibitor called upadacitinib at 45 milligrams once daily resulted in significant improvements in abdominal pain, bowel urgency, and fatigue in patients with active ulcerative colitis, or UC, who were relapsed or refractory to a previous conventional or biologic therapy. The U-Achieve maintenance study included 451 participants who achieved clinical remission on upadacitinib induction therapy. These participants were then randomized to upadacitinib at 30 milligrams once daily, and there was 154 patients in that arm, upadacitinib 15 milligrams once daily, and that was 148 patients in that arm, or placebo, and that was 149 patients in that arm. The clinical endpoints were self-reported abdominal pain, bowel urgency, and fatigue. At week 52, the participants receiving upadacitinib maintenance therapy were significantly more likely to report no abdominal pain than patients receiving placebo, And that did seem to be somewhat dose-responsed, because at 15 milligrams, it was 45.9% of the patients reported improvement. At 30 milligrams, that jumped another 10% to over 55%, and the placebo group had a 20.8%. Similarly, a significantly greater proportion of participants in the upadacitinib arm did not demonstrate bowel urgency, and that was again somewhat dose-dependent, with 56.1% reporting that improvement at the 15 milligram arm and 63.6% in the 30 milligram arm. Compared with the patients in the placebo arm, it was only 17.4%. In addition, fatigue was less common in the upadacitinib groups, as was measured by the Functional Assessment of Chronic Illness Therapy Fatigue, so the FACIT-F scores, of greater than 40. The 50-milligram group reported 52% reduced of fatigue, 55.7% of the 30-milligram group reported less fatigue, and that's versus the 35.7% of the placebo group that reported less fatigue. And we have some good news for chronic pouchitis. So this was the phase 4 EARNEST trial, which is the first and largest randomized controlled trial to demonstrate significant benefits of a biologic therapy in patients with chronic pouchitis. This was presented by Professor Simon Travis from the University of Oxford in the UK. And he said, quote, "Although antibiotics are the standard treatment for acute pouchitis, therapies for chronic antibiotic refractory pouchitis are lacking," end quote. And that was the rationale behind this double-blind, placebo-controlled EARNEST trial, which randomized participants with chronic pouchitis after proctocolectomy with IPAA for ulcerative colitis, which randomized 102 patients with chronic pouchitis after proctocolectomy with IPAA 1:1 to either vedolizumab at 300 milligrams administered intravenously at day 1 and then again at weeks 2, 6, 14, 22, and 30, or to a placebo arm. Additionally, all patients received ciprofloxacin for the first 4 weeks, 500 milligrams twice daily. And remission at week 14, defined by Modified Pouchitis Disease Activity Index, or the MPDAI score, of less than 5 and a greater than or equal to 2-point reduction from their baseline, was the primary endpoint of this study. Vedolizumab outperformed placebo with respect to the primary endpoint in a significant manner, with the MPDAI remission of 31.4% versus 9.8% in the placebo arm. In addition, the MPDAI response favored vedolizumab over placebo after 14 weeks, with a 62.7% meeting that endpoint versus 33.3%, and also at 34 weeks, with a 51% versus 29.4%. Moreover, sustained MPDAI remission rates were higher for the vedolizumab arm than in the placebo arm, with a 27.5% versus 5.9% difference. Furthermore, larger histologic and endoscopic improvements were seen in patients who were treated with vedolizumab. Professor Travis repeated, quote, "These improvements in pouchitis disease activity among patients treated with vedolizumab were reflected in improvements in health-related quality of life," end quote. The safety analysis did not show new safety issues of vedolizumab, which was great, and treatment-related adverse events occurred in 21.6% of the placebo group versus 23.5% in the vedolizumab group, respectively. So in total, there were 5 adverse event-related treatment discontinuations reported in the placebo arm, but there was only 1 in the vedolizumab arm. Professor Travis said, "On the 31st of January 2022, vedolizumab was approved by the EMA for the treatment of adult patients with moderate to severe active chronic pouchitis who underwent proctocolectomy and an inadequate response to antibiotics," end quote. In a presentation by Dr. Gianluca Pellino from the University of Campania, Luigi Vanvitelli in Italy, he talked about an interesting study looking at the benefits of segmental colectomy versus a total colectomy in patients with Crohn's disease. And he said, he started off by saying, quote, "According to existing guidelines, segmental colectomy, it's appropriate in patients with a single involved colonic segment. However, data on segmental and total colectomies in patients with Crohn's disease and multiple involved colonic segments is limited and of low quality. And so that was the rationale behind a trial that they called the Scotch trial, which aimed to compare the surgical recurrence rates between these two approaches, as well as the perioperative complications and stoma formation rates in the segmental versus the total colectomies in patients with primary colonic Crohn's disease. And there were 687 patients in this trial. Segmental colectomy was defined as the resection of 1 to 3 segments, whereas total colectomy involved the resection of greater than 3 segments. The surgical recurrence rate was significantly higher in participants who underwent total colectomy compared with those who underwent segmental colectomy with a significant p-value. This result did not change with respect to the location of the involved segments. Furthermore, the participants who underwent total colectomy had an increased risk for a temporal stoma at 31.6% versus 21.4%, or a permanent stoma at 39.3% versus 8%. In addition, readmissions occurred more frequently in participants who underwent total colectomy at 6% versus 2.1%. Perioperative complications were numerically more frequently reported in the total colectomy arm than in the segmental colectomy arm, but they did not differ significantly. The rate of major complications was similar for the two groups at about 10% for both groups. Interestingly, not receiving biologic therapy was a significant predictor of recurrence, with a hazard ratio of 5.4. In addition, perianal Crohn's disease and Crohn's disease diagnosis prior to the age of 18 years were predictive of recurrence with a hazard ratio of 2.7. This was a phase 4 trial called SPARE. It was presented by Dr. Edouard Louis from the University Hospital in Liège at Sart-Tilmon in Belgium. So Dr. Louis started off by saying, quote, infliximab in combination with anti-metabolite therapy is a standard of option for patients with Crohn's disease. However, clinicians may contemplate de-escalation of this therapy if sustained remission is achieved, and the current prospective randomized controlled phase 4 SPARE trial aimed to assess the relapse rates in patients who continued or withdrew from this combination therapy, end quote. So to that end, patients with Crohn's disease, and there were 211 of them, treated with infliximab and antimetabolites who achieved sustained steroid-free remission of at least 6 months were randomized to infliximab withdrawal, and that was 71 patients, antimetabolite withdrawal, those were 69 patients, or therapy continuation, and those were 71 patients. If relapse occurred, participants were retreated with the agent that they withdrew from. The primary endpoints were relapse rate and time spent in remission over 2 years. Participants who withdrew from infliximab showed significantly higher relapse rates than participants who continued the combination therapy at 40% versus 14%, or patients who discontinued antimetabolite treatment 40% versus 10%. Notably, 22 out of 23 participants in the infliximab discontinuation arm who relapsed and were subsequently retreated with infliximab achieved remission rapidly. This trend is reflected in the mean time spent on remission, which was only 6 days shorter in the infliximab arm compared with the continuation arm and 14 days shorter compared with the metabolite discontinuation arm. Although these differences are small, the pre-specified non-inferiority criterion for stopping infliximab was not met. So in short, in patients with Crohn's disease who achieve sustained remission on infliximab plus anti-metabolite therapy, infliximab discontinuation was associated with a seriously increased risk of relapse. In contrast, the anti-metabolite discontinuation did not lead to such a high relapse rate compared to the continuation of the combination treatment. Since physicians often contemplate de-escalation of infliximab plus anti-metabolite therapy, these results really kind of add to that decision-making process of treatment de-escalation in patients with Crohn's disease. This talk presented by Dr. Clara Kanenpale from the Catholic University in Leuven in Belgium has this very interesting idea of talking about super donors for fecal transplants. This was the RESTORE UC trial, and it looked at the use of super donor stools for fecal microbiota transplantation, or FMT, and whether it outperformed autologous stools in initiating remission in patients with active ulcerative colitis. So she started off by saying, quote, FMT, it's a novel therapy for inflammatory bowel disease, and it's shown variable success rates in randomized controlled trials. The results of these trials indicate that the efficacy of FMT may be influenced by donor and procedural characteristics. Therefore, our study aimed to assess whether the donor preselection on the microbiota level using a strict anaerobic approach and repeated FMT administration, so therefore, may enhance FMT outcomes in patients with active ulcerative colitis. So there were super donors were selected, excluding those with bacteroides to enterotype or those with high proportions of Fusobacterium, E. coli, and Veillonella. Donors with the lowest microbial loads were excluded. The enrolled participants were randomized 1:1 to autologous FMT or super donor FMT. The primary endpoint was steroid-free clinical and endoscopic remission after 8 weeks. Results of the 66% futility analysis were presented at ECHO this year, and there were 70 patients. The primary endpoint was not met. Superdonor stools were not associated with higher rates of steroid-free clinical and endoscopic remission than autologous stools, and that was 10% versus 13.9%, with a p-value that was really not significant. The secondary endpoints displayed similar results. FMT was in general safe and well-tolerated, according to Dr. Kane-Appel. In total, 76.9% and 23.1% of the patients, it did experience adverse events in the autologous arm and in the superdomer arm, respectively. Two serious adverse events were reported, one case of dysuria and one case of worsening colitis. Both of these events occurred in the autologous arm. Interesting data. That's it for this podcast. Thanks so much for listening to us, and I hope that you learned something. It's always interesting to hear about ECHO and the rapidly evolving world in the treatment landscape. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.